A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Let's go back to your upbringing in the northeast of England. Tell us about that, please.
It was a wonderful, wonderful upbringing. I must admit, we were a big family, Irish descent. Not a lot of money about. We were pretty poor. There was nine of us in a little three-bedroom terraced house. But to be honest, I've got lovely, wonderful parents, and they brought us up very well. And it was the happiest childhood one could have.
That's lovely to hear. I mean, I understand you've got an army of brothers and sisters, yeah?
Yeah, I have.
How many with each?
There were seven of us, so I've got four brothers and two sisters.
And then two of your brothers went on to be professional boxers.
They did. Gary and Sean both did.
Any good? Were they good?
They were okay. We had some pretty hairy sparring sessions, I must say. So they kept me on my toes.
And one of your brothers, David, as if your parents blessed them, hadn't already got a big enough Irish family, he was adopted or fostered into the family, yeah?
David became number seven when we were just toddlers. My mother, you know, very low income and very little we had, but she's an angel. And so is my dad. They're just fantastic people, and they decided that we needed a bigger family, so in came number seven, David, into which was, I must admit, my first feelings of David was a little bit sort of angry and all that, because he got my bed. I had a bunk bed, which meant then I had to share with my two other brothers, Gary and Sean, right up till I was 18. Yeah. Bearing in mind, they were the two fighters in the family.
Not good.
So you can imagine what it was like. Even in bed, we were fighting.
Well, we'll hear more about David because he's inextricably intertwined with your own life and success. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. Glenn, as we're going to hear over the next couple of hours here on TalkSport, you're a man who can turn his hand to many things. We know from your work on Sky Sports, you're a pretty smart bloke. How did you get on at school?
Absolutely terrible. I hated school. I can still remember the first day at about 4 year old, my mum dropped me off, cried my eyes out, sat in the sandpit, hated it every single day. And the only record I got at school was for not turning up. And then the last year, they just gave up on me. I just didn't bother going. It was because at that time, also, it was kind of, I was a little bit rebellious and a bit of a bad boy.
How bad, Glenn?
Well, just sort of playing truant and, you know, trying to steal the leather from scrap yards and steal it, you know, that sort of stuff. A little bit of, me and David used to go to the local superstore, and I hope they don't hold this against me, but he was great for a little bit of shoplifting. You could always hide stuff in the back of his wheelchair.
Hang on, your brother's in a wheelchair, and you're using him as a mobile shoplifting device. Goodness.
He was the greatest decoy that we had. We had a great little scam going on because nobody ever suspect us. So a few little things, nothing bad. Yeah. But I think I could have been heading the wrong way, and I must admit that I think boxing saved me. But the one thing I was good at school was anything athletical, be it football, rugby, athletics. And the only thing I didn't do at school was boxing.
In an area, as we'll go on to talk about a little later, of particularly as you were growing up there, tremendous unemployment, and you're not trying particularly hard at school. Had you in your mind what you wanted to be, Glenn?
Well, to be honest, I thought like my uncles. There was two industries in Northwest Durham. There was Concert Steel Company, and there was the mines.
Yeah.
So growing up, I thought, you know, what do I need to stick in a school for if they're going to send me down underground? And I had a real you know, nightmares about the steel company and the pits, you know, because it was, I'd see, you know, my uncles all died with the pits. So I was probably the one person in the Northeast that was glad that Mrs. Thatcher closed them all. But what it did do was provide the biggest, we were the biggest unemployment black spot in the whole country.
How did you get into boxing and how did you develop as a young boxer?
The boxing has always been in my family. My family, my granddad was a champion in the forces. His brother boxed for the European title, but he boxed under the name of Jim Palmer, but his name is Jim McCrory. So my dad was going to take my brother to take Gary to a weightlifting gym up in the local sports center at Consett. And I just, you know, being a 12-year-old, wanting to go with him, start to pester them and all, and they wouldn't let me go, so I cried. so they took me along, and I remember to this day, it's so vivid memory. We looked in, we went to go, and Gary was going to train in the weightlifting gym, and I opened the door next door, and it was the boxing gym, and it was just I just remember seeing the color, you know, the bright boots and the vests and the gloves, and it was just action. And all of a sudden, it was like, whoa, I can see it as vivid as ever. I see the faces exactly as they were, the coaches, the boxers, you know, who was skipping, everything. It was just all of a sudden, that was something that I wanted to do. But I still loved, you know, I loved football. I was, you know, George Best was my hero, and then Supermac mm-hmm. came to Newcastle, so, you know, he took over as a massive hero. But I think the moment that changed my life and give me the inspiration, made me want to be a fighter, was Muhammad Ali. I remember, and it was probably a recording, I don't know how long after I seen it, I won a sword, but it was 1974 and it was George Foreman. He was a man that was supposed to get beat, it was never going to, you know, he was going to be destroyed, or worried for his life, and he said he was going to win, and he said what round he was going to win in, and then he did it, and from that moment, he was my hero, boxing yeah. was all I was ever going to do.
You were a pretty good amateur.
Yes, I had a natural knack for it. I've always had a bit of a stubborn, bit of a rebellious streak, if I'm honest, and what really happened was terrible. Was I won the junior ABA championships, but I was also playing football. You know, I was district and county football. I was a county athlete, captain of the rugby team. You know, and I loved doing all sports. I remember I just won the junior ABA national title, and it was our school assembly, and they got, you know, they were giving out medals for who, and it was who'd won the Stanley Cross Country and who'd won this and who'd won that. Local little things. The Stanley District football, and they never mentioned that I'd just become the British national champion, and that never mentioned at all. And my teacher said to me, "You're not going to get on the football team if you carry on boxing." So that was it. So I just quit everything. I just quit everything, you know, and said, "That's it. Then I'm not doing anything. I'm just going to box."
And you got better and better and better. What stage did you realise, I suppose, when you start to come to national recognition in the ABAs as amateurs, you must start thinking about turning professional?
To be honest, I never really had a great deal of inspiration in, because my heroes didn't wear vests. Amateur boxing was just, for me, it was, you had to do that to get into the pros. So although I was quite successful and I managed to represent my country and proud of that, I just wanted to be a pro. The sooner I could get that vest off and fight for real, I would.
Tell us about turning pro then, please.
My coach had struck up a relationship with a man called Doug Bidwell, who had Alan Minter as a manager, managed Alan Minter.
Went on to be a world champion himself, of course, yeah.
Yes, Alan was world champion, I think, around about that time. And they struck up a friendship. He said, I've got a good youngster. If I'm honest, I should have looked into it a little bit more and looked about, but I didn't know anything. So we signed, I turned professional at 18. I had my first pro fight at 19. And I was only a light heavyweight, so I was only 12 stone 6 all through my amateur career. And I was, you know, I was just 19. But he had an opponent, a smaller heavyweight, so a cruiserweight really, but the cruiserweight division hasn't been established at that point. So he pulled out a few weeks before, so they brought in undefeated heavyweight called Barry Ellis, who'd mm-hmm. had three fights, won all three. And this was taking place in somewhere like one of the hotels in Mayfair, and Colin Hart was there. You know, the top press was there, and I was just, you know, I was just a little fighting on the bit. I was petrified. I was thinking, this is going to be, you know, I'm fighting the undefeated heavyweight. I'm 12 stone 10. Kind of the best thing happened, but the worst thing happened. I knocked him out in 90 seconds, and Colin Hart wrote back page of the Sun, the White Bruno, and so my career was launched right from then. So there was no way I was ever going to be a light heavyweight. So straight away it was then all about putting weight on,
yeah,
trying to bulk me up, and what that did was just make me after a good start. I think it was 13 or 14 successful wins as a heavyweight. They then put me in, and I was only 20. They put me in with a big local guy called John Westgarth. I was starting to struggle because I was starting to become slower. You know, they bulked me up, and I knew things. You know, I wasn't as good in the gym. I wasn't as quick, and I was, you know, I was getting tagged off fighters. I could beat much easier, and then the inevitable happened. I got stopped. I got beaten.
Yeah, got beaten by, as you say, by John Westgarth. I mean, the early months and year of your fighting career, as was the way back in those days, I don't think it's quite the same now. People are much more closely managed. You had a lot of fights, you know, you, as you say, 10 or 12 fights in just over a year and a half. What was life like for you then? I mean, were you earning a living from...
It was very, very hard. I was being paid peanuts. My manager had me in digs. I was subsidizing my fight money, this is how bad it was, with going on the dole. So that was very hard. And I also had a girlfriend, and we had lots of problems between me and her up here, and eventually I had to get married. So there was a lot going on at that time that was really, 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 you know, disturbing and hard for me. And I think the whole thing just took its toll, and I went through a really bad patch.
We're going to hear in the rest of this program about how you become a cruiserweight and go on to be world champion. And it's an unlikely story, Glenn, if you think that between, as I say, you lost to John Westgarth at the Gateshead Leisure Centre,
yes,
which you just described how difficult that was. Then you won a fight in Gateshead of a man called Roy Skeldon. Mm-hmm. And then in the following, between April and October of 1986, you lose four fights on the spin in 6 months. I mean, that would be enough to put the end to most people's idea of being a professional boxer, never mind being a world champion down the line. What happened to you then? I'll give you the names. I mean, you probably remember Rudy Pika.
Yep, who's undefeated, very, very, very good fighter, you know, who's a house fighter. That was at the Albert Hall. What happened was, I think my manager, his dream got busted that I wasn't going to be the next sensation. I was taking fights at 5 days' notice because I was on the dole. The final run, Trevor Curry, who I'd handled easily in sparring years before that, I got knocked out in two rounds. Didn't train at all for it. The only thing I did was some pads, because by that time I'd left London, didn't have a gym, but needed the money. And the only thing I did was some hit the pads with my wife holding the pads.
I had
no trainer.
Where were you doing that?
Didn't have anything. That was for the Trevor Curry fight.
But where? I mean, where was your
in
wife?
In my house in Stanley.
In the front room.
In my front room. That's how bad my career was being looked after.
When you lose those consecutive fights, and you say you're clearly not even training for some of them, did you feel like packing it in at all, Glenn?
Very much so. And I was getting loads of pressure because my then wife hated me boxing. She didn't want me to box. She wanted me to get a job. So I was getting lots of pressure from her. I was on, you know, I was on unemployment benefit. There was no employment in the Northeast, and I had no qualifications. So it was very, very, you know, we got a house taken off us, a little terraced house that we had. It was real dire times. And you're trying to then fight, you know, good quality opposition with no trainer, no gym, you know, just doing it on your own. So it was a desperate time. But I remember on one of my early fights at the Grosvenor Park, it was about my sixth fight, I boxed in front of Muhammad Ali, who was the guest of honor.
Wow.
And it was Henry Cooper. I think Ali was over for Parkinson, the Parkinson show. And yeah, then he was doing a boxing show. And it was at the Grosvenor Hotel, I believe. So I got the chance. This is early in my career, about my fifth or sixth fight. I got the chance to fight in front of my hero. And I boxed, and I didn't box that good because I just wanted, all I wanted to do was relate something to him, just to tell him how much I thought of him, how much I admired him, you know, how much I loved him. So I did the Ali shuffle and wound my arm up and didn't box very well, but I won the fight. So afterwards, I'm upstairs, and I'm taking my boots off, and Jarvis Astaire, the famous promoter.
Big-time promoter,
yeah. Big-time promoter. He popped his head around the corner and said, McCrory, fasten your boots. Muhammad Ali wants to meet you. Can you imagine? Muhammad Ali wants to meet you. I ran, you know, got ready, went down to see him. He put his arm around me. He pulled the old Ali face, and he wanted pictures with me. And he was, you know, he was absolutely just the most wonderful, wonderful man. And he said, mark my words, mark my words, you will be world champion. You will be world champion. And I just thought, for somebody to take the time to a youngster that he didn't know anything about, was a marvelous thing. So the one thing that through all this bad times, and I knew there were so many reasons why it wasn't going right. One was my weight. You know, I was starting to be, you know, I was fat and out of shape. And the problems I was having at home in my relationship was all adding to that sort of thing. But the one thing that got me through was I thought, if Ali saw something in me, if Ali saw that, you know, Ali was always right. He was always right. So it was then that it all sort of fit into place. I was, after the Curry fight, I was very depressed, and I got ill one night. You know, we had no money. I was sitting, eating a load of chocolates and rubbish. And I went upstairs and was violently sick. Violently. I must have caught a bug. And I was ill for about three days. And then I went up. My mum lived about four doors up. And I remember I went up to my mum, and they were like, oh my God, what's happened to you? Because I must have lost the stone and the harp. Mm-hmm. And I was like, do you know what's happened to me? I know exactly what's happened to me. I'm going to be champion now because I'm a cruiserweight. I know exactly what's wrong. You know, they feed me all this rubbish on my dole money. I hired a little above a fruit and veg shop. There was just a little tiny room. And I got my dad's friend to put a hook up there, and we hung a bag. And from that gym, I won the British, the Commonwealth, and the world title.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Down.
You mentioned that you were a good footballer as a kid and that your own heroes were George Best and Malcolm McDonald. I take it, like a lot of people, because you come from that part of the world, Newcastle United were a big thing for you.
Still are,
I presume.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, still are. I've got a kitchen that overlooks St James's Park.
Really?
But I think my love affair, it's funny, if you're in Durham, you'll find that, you know, people at different ends of the street either support Sunderland or Newcastle. You know, it's one or the other. My family, there's me and David support Newcastle. The rest of the family are all Sunderland fans. And, you know, one of them, my brother Neil, he's a season ticket holder and has been, you know, and he's a massive fan. So on Derby days, they're quite tense.
Yeah, they would be. Can you remember, I mean, there's that advert currently running, I think, on Sky TV, with Alan Shearer, remembering his first time going to St James's. Can you remember going to the ground the first time?
Do you know, my first memory is going past the ground, because we went to, as little kids, and my dad's all beat up Ford Cortina, so there's six kids and my mum and dad in the Cortina. We were going to an orphanage. My mum was going to find another brother and sister, and we went past St James's, went over the bridge, went past St James's Park, and from someone that grew up in little small terrace street in Anfield Plain, it was, wow, it was just, this was just something amazing. And then we went to the orphanage. The rest is history with David. He became David McCrory, but it was first seeing the ground. So it was actually driving past the ground.
So let me get
where
this right.
I became a Newcastle fan, and I became a lover fan. I live in Newcastle, and, you know, most of my adult life I've lived in Newcastle.
Let me get this right then. When you went to get your adopted foster brother, whatever, your brother, let's call him, that was also the day you first saw St James's Park. I mean, that's just incredible.
Yeah, we were. I think I was seven. David was six. We'd never been anywhere. I mean, we went to the local coast in the caravan for our holidays. We had very, very little money wise, but mm-hmm. we had loads and loads of love. So it was a wonderful family. And you never, you know, when you're young, if you haven't got a design, we didn't know anything about designer stuff or anything mm-hmm. like that. When we were kids, we didn't care.
No.
You know, we were fed well and we were loved, and that's all you need.
Well, listen, as you say, the footballer of your generation who was your hero is, of course, still very much a Newcastle legend, is Malcolm McDonald. Super Mac, as you called him at the very top of the show. Delighted to say he joins us on the line now. Hello, Mac.
Hi. Hello, Danny. How are you?
Very, very good indeed. And, of course, a former guest on this show. You see the effect you have on young men. They go on to be world champions, but what they remember is you playing football, Malcolm.
Oh, dear. It's a sad life they lead, isn't it?
Well,
I'm
great, Malcolm. I'm great. It's lovely to hear from you. But my memory is, you know, why I was centre forward, and you know, when Supermac came in, obviously I wanted to be Supermac, didn't I? Because I once got an award of Pop Robson for scoring the most hat tricks anywhere in the area.
Malcolm, you know, Newcastle United, the kind of story has become that they don't win trophies. You were in a Newcastle team, the one that Glenn was watching, which was good enough to reach cup finals and was actually a very good team in its own time.
Yes, it was. The real mystery for me is that after having been there 4 years and you could sense, or despite the fact that we lost in the 1974 FA Cup final to Liverpool, we were absolutely shocking that day. Liverpool weren't much better, to be honest, but they turned it on a little bit in the second half and finished up winning 3-0. What amazed me was that at the end of the following season, Joe Harvey was just dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Joe, he is the last trophy winner as manager of Newcastle United to this day.
Let me ask Glenn, and then you've got Malcolm there to make the comparison, if you like, Glenn. You've been to some of the biggest boxing matches in the world, and you're both as a fighter and more recently in your role at Sky Sports. Is it possible to compare? Because one, of course, is the most individual sport, and the other is very much the world's favourite team sport. Is it possible to compare the crowds and the atmosphere at big boxing matches and, let's say, at St James's Park?
Very much so, because it's closed in, it's closer in a boxing. Obviously, they have bigger crowds at football, but boxing's it's right on top of the action. So, you know, but it's very similar. If you've got a great game, it's wonderful. And you know, we've just proven recently with a Froch Groves fight that boxing can even fill Wembley Stadium. And last week at Hull, at the Kingston Rovers ground, that you know, stadiums, we, you know, boxing matches can fill just for fights.
Malcolm, have you ever fancied pulling on the gloves yourself?
Do you know? I just want to know. I think I had a lower body strength rather than upper body. In actual fact, I remember seeing a profile of Rocky Marciano, and he and I had very, very similar physiques, except his arms were much bigger, whereas my legs were much bigger than his. And I just thought, that's incredible, because I'm only I'm less than 5'10", and Rocky Marciano was one of the great fighters of history, and yet he was only a short fella.
Yeah, he was 5'10 and a half, Rocky Marciano.
Yes.
I mean, incredible that people, some of these great, great fighters of the 40s and 50s, heavyweight champions, Glenn, as well, you should make the point, and now they'd have to be fighting on a stepladder because they're fighting actual giants
but,
now.
But actually, when you think about it, Mike Tyson was one of the
one last of the example, small, I guess. Yeah,
he was one of the small heavyweights. But you know, if you train right, there's ways of, you know, Mike Tyson learned how to make the most of his size. You know, he'd get underneath the tall heavyweights and then get inside them. So, you know, he made it work for him, same as Malcolm did on the football field.
The fight is coming up now between Tyson Fury and Klitschko. Malcolm, or even Rocky Marciano, would have been mascots for that one. I mean, it's ludicrous now. Listen, Malcolm, thank you so much.
I would have been in a miniskirt.
with the ring card, absolutely.
I'd pay to see that.
Malcolm, listen, short but sweet, Malcolm. Thank you so much for joining us and just giving us a flavour of the hero that is of tonight's guest, Glenn McCrory. Thanks, Malcolm.
My pleasure. Good luck, Glenn.
Absolutely. Mate. And Glenn, you know, Malcolm McDonald, he's a southerner, but he's made his name and his reputation at Newcastle. That's all part of the thing that I think that people who support many other football clubs don't understand. The size of the city with just one club, and it's also bang in the middle of it, people find it hard to understand just what Newcastle means to the community.
You could say there's three sports in Newcastle: football, and football. And it's that sort of, you know, Newcastle United is everything. On match days, everybody is just talking about what's going to happen. To be right in the centre of the city and for that many people to come, and to have, you know, when we've been disappointed and we've had bad results, but 54,000 people, they cram in there, you know, and I really, really hope we can get some, Steve McLaren can get some silverware, because if ever a club is as passionate, or ever the fans are as passionate, nobody can beat Newcastle United with pure passion. And we really, really, everybody just wants to see some silverware.
Glenn, we spoke earlier about the difficult early days of your boxing career, including those 4 successive defeats, but you did get back to winning ways over Joe Adams, fight in America. And eventually you beat a number of guys, including Barry Ellis, who I think you met in your very, very first fight, on the way to becoming the Commonwealth title holder. Tell us about winning the Commonwealth title.
Well, the Commonwealth title was obviously, it was a major title. And just to go from the terrible run I had to suddenly, you know, finding myself and getting the right weight and things all going good, my sharpness coming back. And I'd met a trainer in America called Bo Williford. So he invited me over to fight in America. I had a couple of fights out there, sparred with the fabulous fighter called James Quick Tillis, who learned me so much about the pro game, because I hadn't really had a trainer till that point. So I learned everything by sparring. I learned everything in the gym from that. And it just went doing very well. Then I had a fight. Frank Warren brought me in to fight a fighter called Andy Strawn. And Andy Strawn, they were building back up. He'd been the British champion. And I think they thought that because I'd had the bad run, that it, you know, this is a good win for Andy. So they brought me in and I knocked him out. So that all of a sudden made me... That got me the Commonwealth title shot, where it was meant for Andy, but it was me that got it. So that was the beginning of it, and shortly after I won the Commonwealth title, I got a phone call saying, "Would you then it's James Tiller saying, do you want to spar with Mike Tyson?
So let me get this right. You've beaten the Zambian Chisanda Muti to become Commonwealth title holder at cruiserweight, and then you get a phone call from Quick Tillis saying, do you want to spar with Mike Tyson?
Do you want to spar with Mike Tyson? And it was, they said, the money's going to be rubbish, Glenn, because they don't think you'll hack it because he's knocking everybody out here. I mean, people like world champs, like Oliver McCall, were sparring partners, you know, for Tyson. So it was a pretty awesome thing. But I thought, you know what? This is going to be the best experience of my life. If I can hack it in sparring with Tyson, if I can do something, what confidence I'm going to get. Because I lost all my confidence through a bad run. So I thought, you know, no better way than to throw yourself in the lion's den. I hadn't made very much money for the Commonwealth title fight. And I thought I'd go out. They offered me $200 a week to spar with the meanest man on the planet because they thought I would only last a day or so. But I was there five weeks.
Well, I think we should make the point. You were a very good defensive boxer, Glenn. I mean, that will have held you in good stead against Tyson.
Well, because also being a cruiserweight, I was very, very quick. So, you know, I learned to survive. You'd do two rounds or four rounds.
Yes.
You'd use five different sparring partners. And there was only once I give Mike a black eye. He got a mark around his eye, swollen up a little bit, and they didn't spar for a couple of days. And I'd done it. And so Mike Marley, who was the New York Post reporter, was there. Well, he made, obviously, you know, Mike Tyson, skinny little Irish kids just beaten, because they, you know, McCrory, they skinny little Irish kids just beat up Mike Tyson. So it was full page of the New York Post. It did great for me, except it was the only time that I had to do six rounds with Mike, which were the toughest six rounds of my life. And I think it was payback time for Mike. But it was a great experience.
Did you get to know him well?
Yes, very well. Yeah, very well.
How did you find him? Because, of course, his reputation, been in prison, all the rest. How did you find him, Glenn, on a personal level?
I found him at that time. At that time, he was wonderful. He was, you know, he was with Kevin Rooney. He had a great team around him. He was very, very... You know, he's very, very friendly. He was vicious, totally, totally ruthless. Would knock fighters out without any care in sparring. But then was very, very friendly and very nice. He loved the fight that had come over, and I think all of the other sparring partners were black and had trainers with them. I was a white kid that come in with no trainer, and I think, you know, and I got in the ring with him. And you know, gave my best, and I think I earned his respect. And I think you know, for him it was like, whoa. Either this kid's nuts, just you know, that did it, that won him over. So Mike was great with me. A few years later, when the wheels came off his career, I then the next time he saw me was standing, you know, and he thought I was just a rough kid. I didn't have any money. He knew I was a rough kid. He knew I was tough and was poor and didn't have anything. But the next time he saw me, which was weird, I'm standing with a suit on and a microphone in my hand, and it was like. But he, you know, by then he'd had a bad time. He'd been to prison,
sure.
And then we got the other side of we then got the dark side of Mike Tyson, and that was a bad one. Cause I think he thought I'd kind of sold my soul to the press, and he didn't like the press. So we had a funny little relationship. But we'd always end up getting interviews because of my friendship.
Absolutely.
He would always give us an interview.
And I know you sparred nearly 100 rounds with Mike Tyson by the end of it, which obviously held you in good stead in your boxing, because in the next fight, after winning the Commonwealth title, you were fighting for both the British and the Commonwealth title against a man called TJ. With these two crowns, did you think you were on the road to being a world champion?
I always believed I'd be a world champion. I always thought, you know, that was my goal. That was my only goal. Everybody all my life said, from school, from the boxing club, everybody I met, you'll never be a world champion. You'll never be a world champion. So that's all I got. So it was almost pure defiance that I was going to be a world champion. Nothing was going to stop me.
Well, in June of 89, you do get a chance to fight for the cruiserweight title of the world, with the IBF version of the title, against Patrick Lumumba. This is extraordinary, isn't it? Because you're one of the very few people who gets to fight for a title in the village they were born in. I mean, that's literally true, isn't it?
It is. I walked up the street. I walked a few hundred yards up the street from my home, a terraced house at the bottom of Stanley Front Street, to the top of the street to go to the fight. And I remember as I walked up the street thinking, what's going on in Stanley? because all these people with dicky bow ties on. And I walked up, and it was surreal. I was thinking, what on earth is going on in Stanley now? And then there was crowds waiting for me when I got to the top of the leisure centre, and I was, this is for me. And it was just so surreal.
And Patrick Lumumba, as I say, will say he'd been a world amateur champion, so, and he was a tough cookie. He'd also been a sparring partner with Mike Tyson. Tell us about the fight, Glenn.
Well, I think I've got to tell you before the fight, because it was a pretty tough moment for me the morning of the fight, because I got the paper, and as you said, Patrick Lumumba was a world amateur champion. He was very avoided. You know, they had to give him fights with heavyweights. He was a rough, tough, something of a nasty personality. And people avoided him. Nobody wanted to fight Patrick Lumumba. And when Evander Holyfield moved up, you know, surprise, surprise, I knew he'd be the one that I would get. And I remember on the day, Colin Hart had also witnessed, who Colin's a great friend of mine, and I think the world of him.
Mm-hmm.
But he launched my career. But then on the day of the fight, there was a write-up, and it said, Glenn's a goner. And it was basically like, I had no chance at all. And I remember being absolutely just like, oh, wow. People think I'm going to get beat. And it was at that moment, I had a little private moment thinking, Glenn, how much do you want this? How much do you want this? And I thought, I'm prepared to die for this. I'll die for this. I bet he's not. And at that moment, when I realized how much I was prepared to give, then I knew that the title was mine.
And it went the full 12 rounds. The judges' scorecards were absolutely unanimous, and absolutely you won virtually every round, according to some of the judges, and become the champion of the world, something that you dreamed about, even in the dark times when you were losing fights, Glenn. And yet I've read about it. It was a difficult and an emotional night for you and day following, in that it was in some ways the best day of your life, in some ways the worst feeling, because you'd done everything you set out to do. And of course, it also involved your brother, David, who we'd heard about, who by this stage, I think, was in his wheelchair bound with muscular dystrophy, but he was there that night supporting you.
He was there. He wasn't supposed to be there. My mum wouldn't go to the... It all got too much for her nerves at that point, by fighting in big fights like that. And she wasn't going to go. And because she wasn't going to go, she looked after David, so David couldn't go. And he had been ill just previous to that, so they were going to go, so they stayed in my Andy's house, which is just a few hundred yards from the venue, and they were just gonna, you know, flick the TV on at the end. She wasn't even going to watch it on TV, so David was gutted. But by some miracle, and I don't know, and nobody knows who did it, the police sirens went off, and my mum at first was really, really worried, because she thought something must have happened in the fight, something very bad had happened in the fight, because the sirens outside. The police knocked on the door and they said, get David, get in the car, we're taking you to the fight.
Wow. So,
but the strange thing is, nobody knew my mum was at my auntie's. You know, she wasn't at home.
No.
So it's still a mystery today, but the police come running in with David, kicked the doors in, dragged them, put them ringside. It was, you know, right at the closing of the fight. And I remember looking down, and it was like a miracle. All of a sudden, there's my little brother. There's my little baby. You know, there's my brother sitting there in a wheelchair with a smile as big. Because, in a lot of ways, David, the relationship with David was, he would never give in. So I couldn't give in. You know, I used to see him every day, and he would fall down but get back up. And it was I'm not going to let my little brother down.
Unfortunately, the illness that he had eventually took him from us at a young age. And I remember reading an interview with you saying that was the night you realised just how much you loved your brother.
Well, he was originally, we just thought he walked a little bit funny, you know, and he wore glasses, and I used to get him on my back and carry him to school, and then bit by bit, he started to get a little bit worse. Then they did an operation to try and fix his legs, and that didn't work. And then it about fit. It was round about the time I won the junior ABA title. So this was what my life was kind of like. I had a great elation, but then it was kind of back down to earth, because my mom was told David had Friedreich's ataxia. David was 15. The doctor was actually quite surprised that he was still alive. Mm. And that was the first time we ever knew that he had something wrong with him that was, you know, was terminal. But he lived, you know, so he was going to go at 14. He fought and fought and fought for life till his body was nothing, was crumbled and but lasted till he was 29. So of all the McCrorys, he's probably the best fighter of the lot.
Glenn, you were the IBF World Cruiserweight title holder, you made two defences of the title. The first against South Africa's, I've got to get his name right here, Cesar Makatini.
Makatini.
That was a successful defence. What are your memories of that night?
My memories, first of all, I need to go back just to tell you about the world title fight. The night with Pat Lumumba, I won the world title, it was the best night of my life. Mm. The next morning, I woke up and it was the worst moment of my life.
How come?
Because I had no more dreams. I had achieved what what everybody said I couldn't achieve. I had achieved it. I had made no plans. I had not wanted to defend it, or I'd never ever dreamt of what would happen after that. So it was kind of, for the first time, I woke up, I didn't want to go for a run. The hunger had gone, and it was such a weird feeling that it must be like you've climbed Everest, you know, and then, you know, you've got to go back down, or are you going to climb it? No, you've done it. And that was what it was like. So it got hard for me.
I hear what you're saying, but that might be something you feel a day or two after a fight, sort of a come down. Did it stay with you, that feeling? Did it become a demotivational factor?
It stayed with me, you know, it'll stay with me for the rest of my days. You know, I won the world title. And from there on, everything was a struggle. I would have retired there and then at 24 and won the world title if I'd made $1 million instead of $15,000, which I got paid, which equated to £7,500. And you know, to say how bad financially off we were at that time and how much I obviously had to continue. If anybody remembers on the night of it was an ITV fight. It was, you know, big Jim Watt and Reg were commentating. It was a big night. I got the microphone. They said, you know, they give me the microphone at the end of the fight. My Rocky speech was, I'd like to thank everybody, but most of all, Stanley Dolophus, because I'm not coming off. Stanley Dolophus, because I'm not coming back. And I officially signed off the dole after I won the world title, because I was still claiming unemployment benefit. That's how little I was being paid.
Well, you did beat the South African Makatini, but your second defence of the title in March 1990 in Gateshead, you ran into an American called Jeff Lampkin, and you didn't win.
No, I didn't, and you know, quite frankly, it was a fight that had things been different, I would have beat Lampkin, but I was given, I got 5 weeks' notice about my own world title fight when I used to blow up. Yeah, I was boxing at 38, which was very hard for me to make. I had no diet, no nutritional advice whatsoever. So simply Lampkin, my only training was saunas and sweat blankets and boiling the weight off and all the rest of it. And I went into that fight knowing I was going to lose. I went into that fight praying that I wouldn't get seriously injured. This is how badly I was actually even thinking in my mind. I got a suit made. 2 days before the fight, I never ever wore that suit ever. It was like I was even doing silly things, you know. I think that's how much weight I'd taken off past the danger level. Luckily for me, Mike Tyson couldn't hurt me with a body shot. Nobody could hurt me with a body shot. But it was thank God it was a body shot, and I was too weak, and it was a body shot that took me. If it had been a struggle and a long fight, you know, I could have been very, very seriously hurt.
Well, listen, thank goodness you weren't. You took nearly a year out after that, and then you won another fight against an American called Terry Armstrong before one of the biggest fights of your career at heavyweight, when you fought Lennox Lewis. I want to talk about that fight, and then I want to talk about the remainder of your career, which ended up, oddly enough, in a fight in Moscow. The one British journalist who was with you in Moscow that night when you had your last fight, of course he was there for Lennox Lewis as well, and indeed has remained your great friend and saw all of your fights. I'm just about to say he is, of course, the chief sports writer for the Newcastle Evening Chronicle and your great mate, John Gibson. Hello, John.
Hi, good evening.
Listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Not at all.
Glenn has told the story in great detail so far for us. Pick us up with the excitement when Glenn, having lost his world title, gets in with Lennox Lewis. I mean, by this stage, of course, he's a household name, and this was a very big fight, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Lennox had actually been on Glenn's undercard up here in Gateshead when Lennox was making his way as an unbeaten heavyweight. And then I'm sure Glenn will tell the story when you ask him about Lewis. But, I mean, really, that was a fight he took on so he could pay the taxman. He had a 70 grand bail and called Lennox out simply to get the tax paid. Glenn was one of the most unfortunate people in the world because the cruiserweight limit then was 13.8, which is absolutely ridiculous. He wasn't a natural cruiserweight in terms of size, and he wasn't a natural heavyweight in terms of bulk.
He was caught between the weights in a way that he wouldn't be now because, of course, they've changed the weights.
Absolutely so. Absolutely so.
Glenn, is that right? You called out the great Lennox Lewis because he needs to pay a bill.
I did. The boxing writers dinner. I should have just went bankrupt. But you know, my management after I'd lost the world title just went off to America, taking half the money with them. I was left with a big tax bill and no expenses, nothing for training camp, nothing to show for it. So I got a big billion. My only thing was I needed to pay this bill. So the only way I thought I could do it was there was one fighter who needed names on his record. He needed world champs to fight, and that was Lennox. So after he sat, and luckily enough, we went to the Savoy, and he was sitting across from me at the boxing writers' dinner. So I said a few things about his waving of the Canadian flag and all, you know, his credibility and a few other things, and asked to fight him in the car park, and he hadn't fought anybody. So Lennox stood up. He knew exactly what I was doing.
Yeah.
Lennox stood up, faced up. We had a face off. Suddenly the camera, obviously it's the boxing writers, so the press are there, and all the press are there. So that was it. It's me and Lennox.
I mean, I'm going to say John Gibson. It's a bit hard to swallow this. Two of the nicest people in boxing pretending they don't like each other. It doesn't work, does it?
it's the game the way it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
They sort of face off before the fight and the kiss and cuddles afterwards. I mean, I was terrified, as Glenn was telling you, I was terrified when he fought Lampkin because I thought he could quite easily die. And it's the only time as a press man I've stood up and shouted into the ring when Glenn went down with a body shot, not to get up, because he could have been killed if he'd got up.
Yeah.
It was different with Lennox. With Lennox, there was no weight problem, but the problem was he had hands like sledgehammers. And
the problem was Lennox there.
With Lennox, yes. I went all the way down to the Royal Albert Hall to watch Glenn because I saw all his fights, and I was terrified in case I dropped the programme and missed a knockout, if you know what I mean. I mean, Glenn's knockout of Lennox, of course, not the other way on.
Sure. Now, listen, guys, you lost that fight, Glenn, and you went back to cruiserweight, and your fighting career, you had some more victories, but it eventually fizzled out in a strange place, in the CSKA Moscow Stadium in Russia in 1993, when you lost to a guy called Alfred Kohl. Now, look, I don't want to talk about that. I want to say to John Gibson, there's a problem here with your friend Glenn McCrory, isn't it? Because he's been on Sky Sports,
yes,
and because he's so erudite about the game of boxing and brings such insight, he's more famous now as a commentator than he was as a boxer. I think Glenn is hugely underrated.
As a boxer?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, well, I think he's hugely underrated, but not by me and not by people that know up here. He is our only ever world boxing champion. I'm talking about Tyneside. And as such, has a very, very special place in people's hearts. But it is true that a career can, you know, pass you by, and you do so brilliantly in the second career. The whole reason for being in boxing is forgotten. But, I mean, even that fight in Moscow was totally memorable because it was the first one after the wall had come down and communism had been kicked out of Russia. It was the first pro-world title fight ever held in Russia because, of course, the war all amateurs.
It was also the first fight where I've been to where you had to check your gun in before you went into the arena.
We heard about you losing that title fight with Alfred Cole in Russia. And now, of course, we know you as one of our foremost boxing commentators, always on, seems to be on Sky Sport. Why did you decide to retire, and how did you make the transition to the media?
I had wanted to retire after I won the world title, as I thought, but I needed to financially to carry on. After Lennox, you know, there's a couple of times I retired after I lost to Lamkin, and I come out of retirement just to try and get the money for that I needed for Lennox. I haven't done that. It's the only time I've ever, you know, my pride was too much that I took a fight. You know, and I trained and I worked hard, but it was for the wrong reasons. You know, I wasn't doing it to win, and I'd always fought to win. So my pride wouldn't let me retire like that. I had to try and see if there was anything left. So it was really fighting Al Cole and getting back to a world title. We got a nutritionist. You know, we had a good trainer in the corner. You know, I trained with the army at Carrick. You know, 3 years later, I made the weight perfectly. That showed I could have been a world champion for a lot longer had I had the right people around me. And that, you know, that's an important thing for youngsters turning pro, to make sure that they've got a camp.
They've got the right firm.
They've got the right people around them, because it's very much, it's an individual sport, but it's a team sport. And if you haven't got the right people, it can be a very, very poor sport, you know, very, very bad sport.
How did you get into the media?
The media, I won the world title, and I did an interview with a fabulous guy called Ian Dark. Mm-hmm. And we did an interview for the BBC, for the radio, and he was so engaging, and he asked so many great questions. And you know, I'm very passionate about the sport, and I love it. And I'm, you know, I read all the old books, and I've got a great, you know, the history of boxing. When somebody's knowledgeable like that, when I'm talking to somebody like that, and he brought all that out. And then he commentated, and the commentary on the radio that evening was absolutely superb. It was absolutely superb, the commentary on the radio, and that was Ian. And then Ian moved to Ian had moved to another company, a new company that had come up. I think they suggested to him, who do you want to work with? And he said, for the very first show, he said, well, I've just, you know, we've just had somebody win the world title, Glenn McCrory. He's in the Northeast. He's not very well known, but he's passionate about boxing. He talks well and all the rest of it. So that was the start of it. And it wasn't at the time. I think it was the old Eurosport, but that was back in 1989.
Wow.
It then became Sky. I was also doing some work for BSB. They amalgamated. It became B Sky B, and the rest is 26 years later.
Well, it's an incredible... I mean, for anybody to keep anything going on television for 26 years is remarkable. Let me ask you an almost impossible question. In that 26 years, you've been to hundreds of fights. You've seen thousands of boxers. What are the highlights and lowlights, do you think? What are the things that, if you were put against a wall, you'd say, oh, I remember that day?
So many great, great fights. Madison Square Garden with Oscar De La Hoya was one of my great, great experiences in New York, the city that I love. One of the worst was Andrew Galotta, Riddick Bowe, the riot in the very same venue, when there was a terrible atmosphere and you just knew something was going to go wrong, and the whole place erupted into a mass riot. Following careers of Tyson, of Lennox, of Oscar De La Hoya, of the great names, the great British fighters, Joe Calzaghe and Ricky Hatton, and you know, it's going on for, you know, it's almost three decades of covering the sport. It's been fantastic. There's been low moments like Michael Watson when I was doing that, and that was for radio. My great friend, you know, who I love to death, Spencer Oliver, when I had to commentate on him when he was critically, you know, he was critically ill, and the paramedics are in, and he's off the hospital, and he's in a coma, and you know, that's the sport. You know, we love it, but it has its extremes. It has its wonderful, wonderful nights, and sometimes it has its very dark nights.
It does indeed. And you know, part of your job, now let's not beat around the bush here, part of most of the people who work for the big television companies to hype up the big fights. They're nearly all title fights now. There's a lot of belts. There's a lot of things. Do you still enjoy the fights down the card where two guys are making their way and they'll wail the tar out of each other for six rounds with virtually nobody watching?
Well, you know, you've just got to think, John mentioned earlier, on my undercard, Lennox Lewis was once like that. That's where everybody starts. So I think that's as important, because all of a sudden, you just, every now and again, you see somebody and you just see a gem, and you just know that they're going to go on and they're going to be something really, really special. So I think it's great. Having seen Ricky Hatton from an 18-year-old, and seeing a young Manny Pacquiao, seeing fighters like that, and then watching them develop and become the great fighters, you know, that they become, is very, very special.
Tell me about some of the other people you've met through your work with Sky. I mean, for instance, outside of boxing, you mentioned earlier on that one of your great heroes is George Best.
George Best, yes, and George works for Sky. Bless him. He's Northern Ireland. My family originate from Northern Ireland.
Do you know
Tyrone.
Okay,
in Tyrone.
I'm only asking because my producer would want to know exactly what part of Northern Ireland. That's all.
In my family, my kids, his grandparents are. My missus is Donegal, so I've got to say up Donegal. Uh-huh. So I'll get murdered if I don't say that. So,
but you were talking about George.
George, yeah. Yeah, he my hero. I kind of had a, and I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but I managed to have a. Can you imagine if you're out and you're having a drink with your drinking with Bestie, and I knew his reputation and all the rest of it, but the couple of times I was drinking with him, he went to bed early.
Oh,
it's like, whoa.
So either he'd reformed or you're a fantastic drinker.
Oh, don't say that. Don't say that. No, it was just, he was great having, I've met people like Tom Jones, and I remember doing a fight with one of Lennox's fights, and I was doing commentary and I was doing in the studio. So I was running up and down between studio, and on one, as I'm clambering over, I put my arm on somebody's shoulder, and I'm like, excuse me, and he turns around, it's Jack Nicholson, who's a big fight fan, and he was like, don't you worry, young man, don't you, and it was
brilliant.
So that was great. And I've got to say, we interviewed a guy a few years ago called Michael Flatley, the dancer, Lord of the Dance, and he just got in touch with me. He got in touch with me and invited me to his last show. He says he's my biggest fan, and we had a fantastic. He was absolutely brilliant. He was such a lovely, lovely man. He took us backstage. Met the cast, but what a knowledge on boxing. And he says,
probably better than your knowledge of dancing.
yeah, better than my dancing. But he talked about, he knew all my fights. He talked about my career. It really is a massive boxing fan. And he said, whenever you're on Sky, just remember the fights, I'm watching you. He was great.
Listen, clearly you've had a very exciting time, but you wouldn't have been doing this for a quarter of a century unless you were really excellent at it. Let's talk to somebody who's worked with you for many, many of those years. Of course, a brilliant commentator himself, and these days head of boxing at Sky, and the absolutely recognisable voice. Delighted to welcome to the show, Adam Smith. Hello, Adam.
Hi, how you doing?
Very, very good.
Hello.
Indeed.
Hello,
hi, Glenn.
Hi, mate.
I mean, the way Glenn tells it, he sort of stumbles into the media, and then he does a bit here, and he does a bit of talking, but it's much more to that. He's a brilliant broadcaster. What are his attributes, do you think, Adam?
He's a fantastic broadcaster, and year by year, he's gathered gravitas and huge experience to the role of commentator, analyst, boxing expert, and also just a fabulous guy to be around. I mean, we've had so many trips over so many years, going right back, and I don't think I'd have ever got anywhere near Mike Tyson if it hadn't been for Glenn. We pitched out wedding for Mike to interview him. Of course, Glenn had many rounds of sparring with Mike back in his heyday. And also, he was so important when we were covering Lennox Lewis, because, of course, he shared a ring with Lennox. So, Lennox had huge respect for him. So Glenn has been a confidant, a partner, a friend, and everything, really. We work so closely at Sky. The team is very tight-knit. And, Glenn's been at Sky for 25 years, for a quarter of a century. We celebrated that at a do in Newcastle just before Christmas last year. And I've been there for now 21 years. And we've gone through so much and seen so many different fighters, and you know, whether it's the top level guys, the Oscar De La Hoyas, the Roy Joneses, the Floyd Mayweathers, all the journeymen, or the, you know, the sort of the guys from the Mexican backstreets, the promoters like Don King, Frank Maloney, who became obviously recently Kelly Maloney, Frank Warren, Eddie Hearn, and Barry Hearn, all sorts of sort of, you know, amazing fight figures, and Glenn's been, you know, so much part of it for Sky. And what I love about him is that, you know, when he goes on air, he's not afraid to speak his mind time and again and go against the grain if need be. And I think that, you know, when you hear Glenn speak, you know he speaks with authority, because not only has he been in the ring, but he's been around so many fighters for so long,
Adam,
that he has huge respect.
I was just about to rather rudely interrupt you to say almost exactly that. You describe the action, and you've talked about your other colleagues, Jim Watt and Johnny Nelson, etc., at Sky. But for me, the person who I listen to when I want to know what the boxers are going through in the middle of a fight, Glenn, in a sentence, will tell you what you can't possibly know because you haven't been there yourself. He will tell you, the viewer, what's happening with the boxers in their minds.
I think that's the key. You know, I learnt under Ian Dark, and there's no better lead commentator in British sport than Ian. And I think the key with Ian and Glenn, and then later when I had the privilege of working alongside Glenn and Jim Watt and others, but, you know, Glenn reads a fight so well. You know, he's been in there, and that's what you want to know. You want to know what a fighter's feeling, what a fighter's thinking, how a fighter's moving. And, you know, he's just so good at hitting it so quickly. I mean, he scores a fight terrifically well as well, but the feeling you get, and I think in commentary it's a conversation, and because we get on, you know, off camera as well, it's really important, and because we've seen so much together, I think that comes through. But, you know, there's no one better than Glenn at sort of, you know, picking up what happens. And as I said, you know, we've got a great cast of characters ourselves with Jim and, you know, and Johnny and new guys like Carl Froch, you know, adding to the team, but Glenn's been there through thick and thin, and I think that he's a vital part of Sky and everything that we've achieved.
And you'll be the latest person to whom I'm going to say this, Adam. I think that Glenn's achievements as a boxer are now overshadowed almost by his achievements as a broadcaster. I think the next time two of you appear on camera, he should be forced to wear his world title belt over his suit.
Listen, I mean, you know, becoming a world champion is the ultimate in boxing, and I know that particular night where he won the world title was really special for Glenn. But, you know, after that, you can't just sit on your laurels. You know, every sportsman or sportswoman has got to retire at some point. And I think it's, you know, it's been great for Glenn that he sort of, you know, fell straight into the media. And at a time when Sky was a baby, you know, Sky was very small, and he's grown with it. And now, obviously, you know, we're a massive company. And I think Glenn's seen it through the years, you know, from ringside and also from other you know, parts and meeting different people over the time, and see it how it's grown, and the fact he's there, and now he can help the younger guys come through as well. And but, you know, I mean, with Glenn and I, it's been the road trips, really, the times we've gone to sort of, you know, Florida to Mexico to, you know, commentate at ringside on greats like Marco Antonio Barrera. I remember going over for the Corrales Castillo third fight, the one that never happened, the first one which was thrilling, the second one which was, you know, won fairly easily, and then the third one it was all set and the fight never happened, and Glenn and I were over there for a few days together. And, you know, it's just that sort of those memories, being ringside for the Lewis Holyfield draw, the scandalous draw, the controversy in New York, or being there for Nassim Hammett and Kevin Kelly in the Garden. You know, great nights, and I think that those memories will stick with us forever.
Well, I like to think of the two of you in a sort of running remake of The Hangover, but what happens in Madison Square Gardens, guys, stays in Madison Square Gardens.
Thank
Adam,
goodness.
I think so.
Adam, listen, thank you so much for joining us, Adam.
Cheers. Cheers,
Adam Smith, there, the most familiar voice in British boxing these days and head of boxing at Sky Sports, just giving us an idea of what it's like to work with Glenn McCrory. Glenn, we'll talk about some of your activities away from the broadcasting these days, but before that, I'd like to, I guess the most high-profile thing that's happened to you in recent months was a strange court case. In fact, it never came to court in the end, but you were arrested and you were under suspicion of all kinds of things, not paying a taxi fare and also assaulting somebody. And I thought, I must admit, I thought, Glenn, hang on, if Glenn McCrory assaults somebody, surely there's no witnesses. I mean, he won't be able to talk about it. But I know it's now, you're laughing now, but I know that you've recently had your sixth child, and even that very happy event was rather overshadowed by this thing hanging over you. What happened?
It was really, I mean, I'd been for a couple of drinks with Gibbo, and it was really quite a misunderstanding. I think I got a cab driver on a bad night, and it was the fear that was, I was 5 minutes away. I was round the corner, and I, instead of walking across the fields, John said jump in that taxi. So I jumped in the taxi, and then when we pulled off, it was I said I need to go to the where I live, just which is 5 minutes away, and he just, get out and walk. Why don't you walk? So he just straight away had an attitude, which gave me an attitude.
Yeah.
It then got into a sort of I'm you know, probably shouted at him and said, like, you know, just take me home. And then he said, well, you know, no. So that's all it was. But I, you know, being pretty stubborn, I was sort of, I wanted to be taken home. He didn't, so he phoned the police. When that happens, I thought, well, you're gonna look ridiculous. He then, I think, must have panicked and said, I'd hit him. I said to the police officer, I'm Glenn McCrory, former champion of the world. Surely you would, I've lost my pudge altogether, or you would have some mark or some injury. But when they've had a complaint, they have to act on it. So then they had to arrest me. Really got quite bizarre, because as I'm coming out of the police station, I'm taking selfies. You know, the police are taking selfies with me and that sort of stuff, which was, you know, so it was kind of like, okay, well, fair enough. You know, everything's going to be okay. But I think what happened was there was obviously a backlog of things going through the court, so it shouldn't have really went to court. It shouldn't have really got to court, because the charges were dropped. But I think by the backlog, it meant I had to appear the first time. And so then when I went to court, I said, I don't even know. You know, we don't even know what the charges are. So then it was, you know, it was put back, and then it was thrown out. So it was all just a huge misunderstanding. But it's funny how things can certainly spiral out of control, and it's a little, you know, it was certainly a little reminder of, you know, the problem I have, and I think a lot of big people have this, is you all of a sudden, you know, if somebody raises their voice, if somebody's 5'2" and they raise their voice and they've had a drink, they're just, you know, people laugh at them, like, oh, yeah, don't be stupid. If you're 6'4" and you're an ex-world champion and you raise your voice, you're all of a sudden, you're intimidating. That sometimes comes across. If you're a big guy, it comes across that you're threatening or you're intimidating. You know, it's just because of your size or your status.
Well, and indeed, you used the word status there, and of course the issue for the police, bless them, is that if you're a public figure, they have to investigate it. Otherwise, someone will go to the newspaper and say he's got off because he's famous.
Of course, of course. And you know, and that was fine. They were doing the job. You know, I mean, there was no hard feelings. At the end of the day, everything was sorted out, and, you know.
Well, thank goodness for that. You've made, we've already talked about your career on television and radio, but you've also done a lot of other things other than the sports commentary. You've made TV documentaries. You've been a boxing trainer. And you've also done some acting. Now, I don't want to overplay the acting, no pun intended, but you did audition to be James Bond.
I did, the Geordie Bond. It was funny that when I went to the audition, that was, and after the audition, my agent at the time said, this is so funny. Can you imagine a Geordie Bond? And I was like, yeah, it'd be like a Scottish one as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but actually, in fact, you were beaten, I think, by an Irish one in the form of Piers Brosnan.
I know. I think he might have done a little bit better than me, if I'm honest. I think they made the right choice.
Well, listen. The you have acted on TV. You were in a Tyne Tees drama called Quayside, and like every self-respecting actor, you've been in Casualty.
It was great. I was we were filming similar episodes. I met a friend there, Ray Winston.
Uh-huh.
I met them. You know, we become friends.
Ray,
from
he
then.
Loves it, boxing.
Yeah, he loves his boxing, and you know, obviously, we got on great, and you know, have remained friends ever since. But I did, you know, Our Friends in the North, and I did Quayside, mm-hmm. Casualty. There was, I had an agent. At one time, it was going. You know, I was doing really well, and I had more income from that than anything else. But then it got to the point where I was literally. I did a TV series in the Northeast called Quayside, which was 6 weeks, and then doing Sky. I was never home. I was just away constantly, and it got to the point where I had to make a decision of what, you know, when true loves, you know, two loves, you know, because I loved my time acting and doing things like that, and you know, I'd do it again. But it was the decision. Sky was starting off, and you know, it was very busy with Sky, so it was one of the two. And obviously, my love, you know, my great love is boxing, and that's what I was best at. And then I made the right decision.
You have made serious documentaries as well for TV.
Yes, I've made three documentaries. One of about Uwe Gallagher, which won an award. This is me and John Gibson. Me and Gibbo, my pal, we sit and have a few drinks, you know, we're very much ideas people, you know, and we're always thinking of something to do. So we come up with an idea for a story about legends that have lost. And we had one in the Northeast, a great footballer called Uwe Gallagher,
mm-hmm.
Who kind of is not remembered and yet had a great career and was a great player, but then tragically took his own life. And we wanted to sort of wonder, you know, what his career was about and why is he forgotten? And it was called Looking for a Legend. We won an award for that. We also did The Meanest Man on the Planet. And this was, again, me and John just talking about who in his day, Sonny Liston was the mean man, who was meaner than more, you know, fighters are tough, but normally, you know, they're normally friendly guys. There's every now and again, you get somebody who's like just a real mean guy. In his era, it was Sonny Liston, who John met and interviewed. And in my era, I had my time with Mike Tyson. So we did a show called Meanest Man on the Planet. And it was looking, we went to Las Vegas to film it. And it was looking at who we thought was the toughest of the tough.
Wow.
Your inside and outside the ring. And that, you know, really enjoyed my time with that. And then, funnily enough, this is how strange things happen, doing the Lennox Lewis fight, Lennox Lewis, Mike Tyson. I loved Jerry Lee Lewis, so I thought I'd go and see Jerry Lee Lewis concert. I went to see him. I met a couple of guys who promote him. They said, you know, Jerry loves his boxing. Will you please come in the dressing room? So I'm in the dressing room. Then I'm on the stage with him when he did his whole performance. It was just amazing. So I'd remembered reading his book that in his book he'd said that his favorite place he ever played was the City Hall in Newcastle, England.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa. So when I mentioned that, he said, yeah, it was you know, back on his tour in the 50s. He said, I loved it. I've never known fans like that. They absolutely were great. So I said, would you come back? So we organized, we got him back, and he did a concert at the City Hall, and we filmed it. It was called Great Balls of Fire, Pet.
Glenn, we're going to talk about your love of food in just a second, but there's one other thing I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't ask you about. It says here in my notes, you are the Deputy Lord Lieutenant of Northumberland. What the hell does that mean?
That means I actually represent the Queen, which I'm not sure if the Her Majesty knows that. I'm sure
I should have been
does.
More polite
I'm sure
to you,
does,
I think.
Though. No, it's a wonderful honour bestowed on me by the Duchess of Northumberland. And it basically, I represent, the Duchess represents the Queen on engagements that she doesn't do. And so obviously they have some deputy lieutenants who represent the Duchess. And I was picked to be that. And it's something that you have till you're 75 years of age. Alan Shearer has the same.
Wow.
Alan is one. Steve Harmiston is one, and I think, you know, lots of notable dignitaries in Northumberland or deputy lieutenants as well. And it's you know, so I will go. I represent the Duchess last week at the school games, the athletics.
Do you have to dress up in a strange medieval costume?
No, not usually.
Okay, no.
But it's lovely. It's we have dinner and up at the castle and a few times, and I've got a real good one this weekend because Tom Jones is playing at Alnwick Castle.
Yeah, beautiful Alnwick Castle.
Yes, and I'm there as a representing Northumberland, representing the Duchess for that. So that's, you get some little perks, but it's great because you go around, you know, to schools. We were, as I say, the athletics and just carry, you know, open some nice functions Go and visit carers and that sort of stuff.
Well, listen,
lots of charity stuff.
Well, good for you. Well done. I'm going to get this right, Deputy Lord Lieutenant. Thank you very much indeed. I also, when I put out on my Twitter feed earlier today the fact I was meeting you and I asked for questions or comments, perhaps the weirdest one was somebody I've never heard of, didn't even know they followed me on Twitter, said, "This is a question for Glenn McCrory. When is he going to take me to a Manchester United game at Old Trafford?"
Yes.
Do you know somebody called Nicola Mills?
Yes, just my partner. She might have a long wait. She might have a wait. She's dying to get me. She comes to the Newcastle when Man U come here, but I'm not sure if I'm going there.
Well, but there's more detail. I told her I would ask you, and then it goes on to say, "I prefer a Liverpool game, but Chelsea or Manchester City is good too. I've not been to one since I met him. # disappointed."
Oh, my word. My word. Wow. It could have went that list.
She's gone public with this now. She's calling you out.
I'm quite happy with that, because if she's just stopped there, that's great.
All right. Now, listen, Glenn, earlier on we talked about your weight problems, but they were a professional issue because you're a boxer trying to fit into a smaller boxer's body. But you do love food, and as I understand it, you really are a top-class chef. Is that right?
Well, I don't know if I'm top-class, but it is. It's boxing's my life. Food's my passion, and it always has been since I used to cook for my mom when I was about 6 years old. You know, having older brothers who were brother and sister that would go out. A little time I got, and the younger ones would go to bed. I got a little time with my mom when I would, and I must have been 7 or something, but it was my time when I got, and I would do start cooking for my mom. She'd be, and it was only Chinese in a box and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was just the love of my mom's not an exotic cook, but when you got my mom, she loves feeding people. So, you know, there's always a meal. It doesn't matter what, you know, if the postman comes, you know, he'll get something to eat. You know, it's that sort of household. So that's instilled in me, you know, wanting to feed people and a love of food.
And I mean, for instance, I know that the new football season, you cook for people in a pub overlooking St James's Park.
I do. We just started. Well, I mean, it's from boxing gloves to oven gloves. I had a little gym above the Black Bull, opposite St James's Park, and I asked Steve Burns, the boss there. I said, can I change? You know, it was a storeroom, and I said, "Can I do something different in there?" And he's, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Can I do food?" And he was like, "We've never done food here before, you know, since he's been here."
Yeah.
Although there was a little bit of a kitchen upstairs in the corner of the gym, so I said, "We give it a go." He said, "Yep, great, give it a go." So it'll be the McCrory KO burgers and a whole host of other things for myself and my friend who's a chef called Glenn as well, and Ollie Bernard. Unfortunately, is on holiday, but Ollie Bernard, who was a great Newcastle player, he's my partner in this.
This is Olivier Bernard, the Newcastle footballer. Yeah,
Olivier Bernard, the Newcastle footballer. He's French, isn't he? So he's bound to be, you know. So he's got a love of cooking as well. So we do that, but we also, what we do is we do courses for the unemployed.
Now tell me
and
about
that's
that.
That's how it all started.
I was going to come on to that. You're teaching the unemployed to cook. What would have used them becoming chefs themselves and going back into the world of work?
We both got asked, and that's how I met Ollie about 3 years ago. We both got asked to get involved in a course with the unemployed where they did employability skills in the morning, and then they did a bit of boxing, something to help them with their morale. To help them, you know, get a little bit fitter, just to feel better about themselves.
Self-confidence, all those things, yeah.
Yeah, and Ollie did the same with football, and we went all around the country, and that was excellent. Really enjoyed it, and it was very fulfilling. I just thought, for me, I didn't think they got a skill from it. So I asked if we could do a cooking one, so we went around we went around Marco Pierre White's kitchens and doing cooking, and they'd learned various skills. But I just thought they didn't get enough, obviously, you know, with a reputation like that, they weren't going to get loose in the kitchen that much, because obviously, you know, it's all got to be done, you know, for his, you know, up to his standard.
Yeah, of course.
So I thought, you know, if I'm not using this room upstairs, it would be ideal. We've got a bar downstairs, so they can, we can do bar work. We've got a little dining room upstairs, so we can teach them silver service, get somebody in to show them silver service and service. And then we've got the kitchen, and I learned the basic cooking skills. Then at the end of the week, they cook for employers. You know, and we just did a course a couple of weeks ago, and we had Newcastle United in, the head chef there, Robert Hendricks, just said, and he was like, we'll hire them, we'll use them. Eldon Square, in two people said, you know, we'll do that. So we're getting lots of employers buying into the course. So it's had a very, very good response. So it's me and Ollie, as I say, from boxing gloves and football to oven gloves.
It's fantastic. That's a fantastic scheme, because it's having some practical outcome at the end, Glenn. Let me ask you two questions. What is your favourite food to eat, you personally?
I love plain food, simple food, but they're cooked very, very well.
And what is your best thing that you cook?
The best thing that I cook, come and taste the McCrory burger.
It's a burger, is it? Okay.
No. I love to cook. I've cooked with Tom Kitchen up in his wonderful place up in Leith in Scotland, and I've worked with him for a day, which was the hardest day's work I've ever done in my life, and it was brilliant. So he had me doing all sorts of filleting fish and doing pheasant on croûte and all sorts of stuff. So I love the whole thing of cooking. People say, did you watch that boxing show, this boxing show? And if I'll take them. It's normally I'm watching Rick Stein or Tom Kerridge or the Hairy Bikers that's my favorite. That's my, and the missus, she has to go in the other room because Nicola gets sick of the sight of cooking.
Glenn, the ring ladies have been in and out of the ring, and we're into round 12 now, and it's a short one, I'm afraid. You obviously have a very busy life. We heard, of course, you've got a house full of kids as well. Where are you in your life today, and what do you look forward to in the years to come?
Well, I think I'm the sort of person that everybody will tell you this. I'm always thinking of stuff. I do love being busy, and sometimes I make myself a bit too busy. And you've said all the different things I like to do. So, I just want to carry on with that. You know, I love my job. It's brilliant. It's very hard to get tired when there's so many good fighters coming through. So that's great. And I've got a lovely family, and I've got two little babies who are great, great fun, who are complete terrors. Beautiful kids and grandkids. So it's always a lot going on in the McCrory household.
Well, it sounds like it might go very well, provided you do get her over to Old Trafford sometime soon.
Yeah, I think I might have to do that.
You've been listening to an archive edition of Talk Sport's My Sporting Life with Danny Kelly. Thanks for listening, and make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, and Spotify for more top Talk Sport content.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.